February 7th, 1999, Westminster, Colorado. 38-year-old Paul Skiba, his 9-year-old daughter Sarah Skiba, and 36-year-old Lorenzo Shiver spend the day performing moving jobs for a company Paul owns before they all vanish without a trace. When the company's parking lot is searched, Paul's moving truck is found, but there is ample physical evidence, including blood and bullet holes, to indicate that foul play took place. There are numerous theories surrounding the case, such as the disappearances being connected to a dispute between Paul and his estranged girlfriend, but no trace of the three victims is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be exploring a missing persons case involving three victims. The 1999 disappearances of Paul Skiba, Sarah Skiba, and Lorenzo Shiver. Over the years, I've received a couple of requests to cover this story, and while it has been featured on a couple of other true crime podcasts, such as Trace Evidence and Unresolved, it is surprisingly not all that well known. Paul Skiba was the owner of a company called Tough Movers, and even though a previous marriage had ended in divorce, he maintained a close relationship with his 9-year-old daughter, Sarah Skiba. During a weekend visitation, Sarah accompanied her father on a series of moving jobs, which also involved another employee named Lorenzo Shiver. It was established that the trio completed these jobs and returned their moving truck to the company's parking lot during the early evening hours, but then something went horribly wrong, and Paul, Sarah, and Lorenzo were never heard from again. The evidence suggested that the victims were ambushed in the parking lot, and the responsible party disposed of their bodies at another location, and the authorities have always been inclined to believe that Paul was always the intended target, and Sarah and Lorenzo were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But unfortunately, since law enforcement made some major mistakes during the early stages of the investigation, crucial evidence may have been lost, and whoever committed these murders would have had ample time to cover their tracks. This case has no shortage of theories, such as Paul's estranged girlfriend being the mastermind behind this crime, and the possibility has even been pushed forward that Lorenzo killed Paul and Sarah before he disappeared on his own. Whatever happened, these three individuals have not been seen in 24 years, so we're going to explore all the different angles on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearances of Paul Skiba, Sarah Skiba, and Lorenzo Shiver. Our story begins in 1999, and two of our victims are 38-year-old Paul Carroll Skiba and his 9-year-old daughter, Sarah Arielle Skiba. Paul was originally born in Centerville, Minnesota, to parents Sharon and Carol Joseph Skiba, who went by the name CJ, and he also has a younger brother named Gordon. Paul would relocate to Colorado and currently lives in Thornton, which is a part of the Denver metropolitan area. For the past 6 years, Paul has been divorced from Sarah's mother, Michelle Russell, who has custody of their daughter and lives in the town of Granby, over 90 miles away. The two former spouses have worked out a visitation agreement in which Paul will travel to Granby to see Sarah every Wednesday, and they will often spend the night in a hotel together. During the school year, Sarah travels to Thornton to see her father every other weekend and gets to spend summer vacation with him. Paul makes his living running a moving company called Tough Movers, which is located in Westminster, another municipality in the Denver metropolitan area. He had previously worked for a number of other moving companies, but when his last boss retired, Paul offered to purchase his moving trucks from him and use them to start his own business. For the past 6 years, Paul has also been living with his mother, Sharon, who got divorced from her husband and decided to relocate from Minnesota to Colorado. Since his job sometimes requires him to work long hours, Paul has offered to take care of his mother in exchange for her helping take care of Sarah whenever she visits. At this particular point in time, Paul is also living with 28-year-old Teresa Donovan, who is described as being Paul's on-again, off-again girlfriend and has a nearly 3-month-old baby boy, but we'll talk more about her later on. On Sunday, February the 7th, Sarah was in Thornton for her scheduled weekend visitation with her father, and while Paul ordinarily did not like to work whenever she was there, he agreed to cover for an employee and close friend named Jerry Bybee, who was busy preparing an upcoming memorial service for his grandfather. Since Sharon's own mother recently passed away, she had gone back to Minnesota and was not available to watch over Sarah. As a result, Sarah would have to spend Sunday accompanying her father on some moving jobs, and they would be assisted by 36-year-old Lorenzo Deshaun Shiver, who has worked for Tough Movers for the past few months. Lorenzo has 2 children of his own, a 15-year-old son named Josh and a 12-year-old daughter named Aubrey, though he is currently separated from his wife, Misha. Lorenzo is now living with Teresa Donovan's sister, Bobby Joe, and while Aubrey is still staying with her mother, Josh is residing at his father's place. So whenever Paul went out on a job, it was standard practice for him to drive to his Tough Movers yard at the corner of 72nd Avenue and Raleigh Street in Westminster and park his car, a 1972 Chevelle, in a fenced-in lot where he kept his moving trucks. On the morning of February the 7th, Paul and Lorenzo presumably both parked their vehicles there before they left with Sarah in the company's biggest truck, a white 1978 Chevrolet brand with red crescents painted on both sides. According to the timeline, their first moving job took place in Thornton at 10:30 a.m. before they headed to Lakewood to have lunch at around 12:50. They then spent the rest of the afternoon performing moving jobs in the towns of Morrison and Golden before they headed back to Westminster. It's believed that they arrived at Tough Movers at around 6:15 p.m. before Sarah made a phone call at 6:22. Very few details about this call have been released publicly, but according to a CNN article from August of 2009, Sarah called a 12-year-old relative of Teresa Donovan's. But it sounds like this was the last time any of the 3 victims were confirmed to be alive. Paul was supposed to drive Sarah back to Quincy in order to return her to her mother, Michelle, but they never showed up, and Michelle was unable to reach Paul on the phone. Michelle would later say that when she called Paul's house, she wound up speaking to Teresa, who sounded very agitated. Sharon Skiba was still in Minnesota and had been expecting a phone call from Paul for reasons I'll get into a bit later, but she did not hear from him. But the following morning, Sharon received a call from Teresa, who was concerned since Paul and Sarah had not returned home the previous night. If that wasn't enough, Teresa had also heard from her sister, Bobby Joe, who said that Lorenzo never returned home either. Teresa told Sharon that she and Bobby Joe had both attempted to report Paul, Sarah, and Lorenzo missing to the Thornton Police Department, but could not get them to take her seriously. When Sharon decided to make her own call to the Thornton PD, she pretty much got the same response, as one of the detectives told her that Paul probably took Sarah out for a ride and was having a good time somewhere. Sometime between 9:30 and 10 a.m. on Monday, February the 8th, Jerry Bybee arrived at Tough Movers for what was supposed to be another moving job with Paul and Lorenzo. As you recall, Jerry had been scheduled to work the previous day before Paul agreed to take his shift, but on this particular morning, Paul and Lorenzo were not there, even though Jerry noticed their moving truck inside the parking lot. Jerry found the situation to be a bit odd, because even though Paul was a very neat and meticulous person who always backed the truck into its space, the truck was now parked there front first in a very crooked position. When Jerry tried to enter the parking lot, he was surprised to discover that the lock on the gate had been changed. He also noticed that Paul and Lorenzo's cars were not parked in the lot, and since they failed to show up, Jerry made his own phone call to the Westminster Police Department in order to report them missing. By this point, Paul had still not returned Sarah to her mother in Granby, so Michelle became concerned enough to file a custodial complaint in Grand County District Court, and the Grand County Sheriff's Office were also notified about the investigation. Paul and Michelle's divorce and their subsequent custody battle for Sarah had been a very bitter and heated one, and since Michelle had recently mentioned the possibility of moving out of state, the Sheriff's Office initially suspected that a parental abduction had taken place and issued a warrant for Paul's arrest. Indeed, Paul did have a history of scrapes with the law, as 18 years earlier, while he was still living in Minnesota, Paul was arrested on a misdemeanor charge and decided to skip out on a scheduled court date. He subsequently fled to Denver and started living there under an assumed name, Craig Nelson, before he was tracked down and arrested. Even though the drug charge didn't stick, and Paul never served any jail time, he was charged with a number of other misdemeanor offenses over the years, such as false reporting, disorderly conduct, and marijuana possession, for which he generally received sentences or probation. While Paul had stayed out of legal trouble for the past several years, and built up a reputation as being a responsible and generous business owner who built up strong relationships with his customers, the authorities still wondered if he may have attempted to flee the area with Sarah. But of course, the big hole with this theory is that it did not explain Lorenzo Shiver's disappearance. By all accounts, Lorenzo was a loving and devoted father who never would have abandoned his own children, and even though he was separated from his wife Misha, they had recently talked about a possible reconciliation. It was not until February the 11th, 4 days after the trio went missing, when an officer from the Westminster Police Department agreed to meet Jerry Bybee at Tough Movers in order to perform a search of the parking lot. Jerry did not have a key to the gate and did not want to cut the new lock for fear of compromising potential evidence, so the visibly annoyed officer decided to slam his car into the fence, jump onto the hood, and climb over the gate. Jerry followed him into the parking lot and soon noticed a puddle of motor oil on the ground, which was partially covered with a piece of plywood. When Jerry pointed this out to the officer, he simply brushed it off and replied, quote, "Can you prove that he didn't change his oil?" Jerry then went to the moving truck, which had been parked in an unusual position, and when he peeked through the windows, he thought the cab looked unusually clean. The officer opened the driver's side door to check inside the cab, but according to Jerry, he only performed a brief, cursory search and didn't find anything. Jerry later stated, quote, "I feel he destroyed more evidence than he was willing to look at. To him, there was nothing unusual there. I was disgusted with him," end quote. Well, on February the 14th, another friend of Paul's named Rich Lesmeister received a phone call from Teresa, who informed him that Paul, Sarah, and Lorenzo had gone missing 1 week earlier. Since this was the first time Rich had heard about this, he decided to get in touch with Paul's mother, Sharon, who had since returned to Thornton from Minnesota, and she expressed her unhappiness about the lack of urgency from law enforcement. In fact, Sharon was so desperate that she had hired a helicopter to fly over the area and search for Paul's missing car without success. Rich told Sharon that they should perform their own independent search of the Tough Movers parking lot and arranged to meet her there with his wife, Carol Lesmeister. When they arrived, they noticed that the gate was still locked, so Rich and Carol climbed over the fence. Since Rich was a mechanic, he had recently done some work to install a new engine on another moving truck that Paul kept in the lot. Rich decided to take a close look at this truck and was surprised to discover what appeared to be multiple bullet holes in the side. Carol examined the main moving truck, which had been parked in an odd position, and noticed a smear of blood on one of the doors, which she described as being an imprint from a bloody shirt sleeve. The couple also found what appeared to be a small chunk of human scalp with hair attached to it near the windshield. Incredibly, this physical evidence had somehow been missed, when the officer from the Westminster PD performed his original search days earlier, so the police were summoned to the scene again. According to Rich, the whole situation escalated into an argument in which the police continued to insist that Paul took off voluntarily, and they threatened to arrest Rich, Carol, and Sharon if they did not leave. Believe it or not, they tried to insist that the blood on the truck's door may have been left there by someone who cut themselves. They also theorized that the bullet holes in the other truck had been caused when someone shot at it while it was moving, even though Rich pointed out that it did not even have a functioning motor at that time. A patrol car from the Thornton Police Department was also summoned to the scene, but there was a dispute over who should have jurisdiction over the investigation. While Tough Movers was located in Westminster, the missing persons reports for Paul, Sarah, and Lorenzo had technically been filed in Thornton. The Thornton PD ultimately agreed to head up the investigation and towed the two moving trucks away to examine them as evidence, but they still left the parking lot's gate wide open and did not secure the scene with crime tape. Paul's father CJ and his brother Gordon soon made the trip to Colorado, and since Paul's family and friends obviously did not have much faith in law enforcement, they decided to perform their own search for Paul and Lorenzo's missing vehicles. On February the 17th, Jerry Bybee discovered Lorenzo's car in the parking lot of an apartment complex located at 3809 6th Avenue in Westminster, several blocks away from Tough Movers. On February the 27th, the Denver Police Department found Paul's 1972 Chevelle in the parking lot of another apartment complex at 3129 Arkansas Avenue in Denver. The vehicle contained Paul's personal belongings and Sarah's backpack, but even though Paul usually kept the exterior very clean, there was mud all over it. Paul and Lorenzo's cars were both wiped clean of fingerprints and did not contain any useful physical evidence, and no tangible links were found between the victims and either of the apartment complexes. Since Sharon was hoping to keep Tough Movers afloat during her son's absence, she asked the Thornton PD to return the two moving trucks when they were done analyzing them for evidence. Even though they complied, Sharon was horrified to discover that one of the trucks still had bits of scalp and hair stuck to the hood. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation, aka the CBI, finally became involved in the case and performed their own forensic analysis of the main moving truck. While the cab and the back of the truck looked like they had been freshly cleaned, the CBI used luminol to find traces of additional blood, and they also uncovered an additional hair on the truck's fender. The CBI also found traces of blood in the parking lot, which someone had attempted to conceal with a puddle of motor oil and the piece of plywood. DNA testing would later confirm that the scalp fragment belonged to Paul, the hair on the fender belonged to Sarah, and blood from the scene belonged to both of them. None of the physical evidence could be matched to Lorenzo, but regardless, the CBI now believed that all three missing individuals had become the victim of foul play, so Paul's arrest warrant for parental abduction was canceled. The truck's 3x10-foot metal extension ramp was missing, along with some moving blankets, so investigators suspected that these items may have contained additional physical evidence and that the truck was used to dispose of the victims' bodies. There was vegetation in the truck's radiator to suggest it had recently been near a body of water, so one theory was that the missing extension ramp was used to sink the victims' bodies. A witness would come forward to report having heard a woman scream near Tough Movers on the evening of February the 7th. Additional witnesses also recalled having seen the moving truck exiting the parking lot sometime between 7 or 8 p.m. that night, before it was returned there around midnight. This timeline suggested that the bodies were no more than a couple hours away from Westminster, so over the next several months, law enforcement dredged a number of different lakes in the area. They utilized the services of NecroSearch, a company which specializes in the recovery of human remains, but they were unable to turn up the three victims or any additional evidence. While law enforcement has never publicly named her as a suspect or person of interest, the individual who has been the brunt of the most speculation is Teresa Donovan, whom I previously described as Paul's on-again, off-again girlfriend. In early 1998, the couple had been broken up for several months, but decided to get together and have sex one night, and a few weeks later, Teresa announced that she was pregnant. Since she struggled with arthritis in her legs, Teresa was on disability and unable to work, so Paul rented her a trailer to live in for the next several months. But when November rolled around, Paul agreed to allow Teresa to move in with them, and she soon gave birth to a boy named Paul Roger. Even though Paul signed the child's birth certificates and allowed him to go by the name Paul Roger Skiba, he would later question Paul Roger's paternity and told friends that he wasn't entirely sure if he was the boy's father. Regardless, Paul still allowed Teresa and Paul Roger to remain at his house because he did not believe Teresa was a stable mother and wanted to keep an eye on the child. Paul claimed there were numerous occasions in which he returned home from work to find Teresa either sleeping or partying with one of the neighbors and neglecting Paul Roger. Of course, Sharon was also living there at the time and did not get along with Teresa, and whenever Sarah visited, Teresa would sometimes get her to watch over the baby while she went out. The week before he went missing, Paul drove Sharon to the airport for her trip to Minnesota and told her he was planning to break up with Teresa for good. He was also going to ask a lawyer to file papers seeking a paternity test for Paul Roger, and if it turned out he was the child's father, Paul planned to fight for full custody. On Friday, February the 5th, 2 days before his disappearance, Paul phoned Sharon in Minnesota and informed her that he had officially ended things with Teresa and was demanding that she move out of the house by Sunday night. Paul asked if Sharon could return home as quickly as possible so she could watch over Sarah on Sunday, but since Sharon was still taking care of a number of things from her own mother's death, she was unable to do so. Paul told Sharon that he would call her on Sunday night to let her know when Teresa had moved out, but of course, Sharon never heard from him, and then learned that Paul and Sarah had gone missing when Teresa called her the following morning. It's also worth mentioning that on the evening of Saturday, February the 6th, Paul agreed to let Jerry Bybee drop off his 11-year-old son Matthew at his place so he could watch over him. Matthew would later say that Paul and Teresa got into such a heated argument that he and Sarah decided to go outside and hide in a playhouse. After Paul and Sarah disappeared, Jerry claimed that when he spoke to Teresa, she mentioned that she had gone to Tough Movers on the evening of February the 7th, but asked him not to tell the police. Now, you might recall that Teresa's sister, Bobby Joe, had been living with Lorenzo Shiver. On the day after Lorenzo went missing, his wife Misha said that she spoke to Bobby Joe on the phone, who told her, quote, "I know he's not coming home. I know something horrible has happened to him," end quote. At the time, their teenage son Josh had been living with Lorenzo and Bobby Joe, but when Lorenzo failed to return home, Josh spent the next few days staying with his mother. On February the 12th, Josh and Misha paid a visit to Lorenzo's residence in order to pick up some of Josh's clothes, but were surprised to discover that Bobby Joe had already packed up everything from Josh's room into boxes, and they were now waiting by the door. It seemed apparent that Bobby Joe wanted Josh to move out permanently because she was certain his father was not coming back, so there was speculation that she knew more about the disappearances than she was letting on. After Paul vanished, Teresa and her baby continued living at his residence alongside Sharon, but when they finally moved out, Sharon changed the locks. Even though Sharon had been appointed to be temporary conservator to Paul's estate, Teresa would eventually take her to court in order to argue that since Sarah had gone missing alongside Paul, Paul Roger was technically his only living heir, so she should have control of Paul's assets. If Teresa was legally Paul's wife, she could become the new conservator of his estate, and while they never officially got married, Teresa argued that they were planning to do so in the near future, and that Paul had bought her a ring at a half-price jewelry sale. However, when the matter went to court, a number of rebuttal witnesses were called upon to testify, and they all disputed Teresa's claims, maintaining that Paul never had any intention of marrying her. The judge ultimately ruled that there was no evidence of a common-law marital relationship between Paul and Teresa, so Sharon was appointed permanent conservator of his estate. However, since Paul had signed Paul Roger's birth certificate, Sharon would now be responsible for paying monthly child support to Teresa. While Sharon tried to keep Tough Movers in operation, it proved to be too much work, so the company would dissolve, and things would reach the point where Sharon no longer had the money to keep paying child support. As a substitute, the court allowed Teresa to take Paul's car and any merchandise she wanted from his house. Over the next few years, Teresa would make appearances on the Montel Williams show and an MSNBC special about this case. While she admitted that law enforcement had once given her a polygraph and told her that she failed, she denied any involvement in the disappearances of Paul, Sarah, and Lorenzo. In fact, she presented her own theory that the trio were murdered by drug dealers, alleging that Paul had been renting them out parking spaces at Tough Movers, and they got angry when he had their vehicles towed. She stated, quote, "They sold Paul drugs, and they were the only people that could have killed him. I don't know if it was over the cars or anger over Paul trying to get over the coke," end quote. Well, even though Paul's friends and family did not buy this theory, there was at least one investigator who seemed to believe it. 3 years after Lorenzo went missing, his son Josh turned 18, so Misha asked Detective Pat Long of the Thornton PD for a meeting in which he could tell them the full truth about what happened. Well, Long agreed to the meeting and informed them that Paul had been using his business as a front for narcotics and got mixed up with the wrong people, so Lorenzo was an innocent victim who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Long later repeated that theory to the media, and while he said that Paul only sold marijuana and had a small client base, Paul's family continued to dispute this. They acknowledged that Paul smoked marijuana, but never did so around Sarah, and did not believe he would have dealt drugs or done anything to put his daughter in danger. There was also some suspicion directed towards Teresa's brother, Tom Donovan, who was known for having a hot temper. Tom had previously worked for Tough Movers, but Paul fired him a few months before he went missing. According to Jerry Bybee, after the disappearances took place, there was an incident where he was driving his truck, and Tom suddenly threw rocks at him while shouting, "You're next, you're next." Sharon also claimed that she received a threatening phone call from Tom, who told her he was glad Paul was dead. Tom then said that both Paul and Sarah had been shot in the head, and the same thing was going to happen to Sharon. Tom later took Sharon and Jerry to court over a debt he said Jerry owed him, and at one point, they saw Jerry pointing his hand at Sharon like a gun and pretending to fire at her. Well, on June the 24th, 2011, Tom found himself in serious legal trouble when he was charged with attempted first-degree murder. At the time, Tom had been living at a motel in Arvada, which is also a part of the Denver metropolitan area, but after he was evicted, he went to see his 59-year-old mother, Kathleen Williams Van Diver. Tom got angry and blamed his mother for his living situation, and things escalated to the point where he grabbed two knives from the kitchen and proceeded to stab Kathleen 5 times. Even though Kathleen suffered a punctured lung and lacerated liver, she wound up surviving. It's been reported that Tom had an extensive history of drug abuse, mental illness, and non-compliance with taking his medication, so after he was arrested for the attack on his mother, his defense attorney entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. However, after evaluating his medical records, a psychiatrist ruled that Tom was legally sane, so in August of 2014, he went on trial for attempted first-degree murder, where he was found guilty and received a 28-year prison sentence. Tom is still incarcerated today, but thus far, no evidence has been found to link him to the disappearances of Paul, Sarah, and Lorenzo. In 2005, Sharon reached out to the organization Families of Homicide Victims and Missing Persons, who agreed to obtain the funding to put up a billboard near Tough Movers, which would spread awareness about the case and feature photos of the three missing victims. Shortly thereafter, the Westminster Police Department announced that they were taking over the investigation from the Thornton Police Department, even though they had previously shown no interest in the case and were not very communicative with the victims' loved ones or the media. Since Sharon was Paul's conservator, she was responsible for paying off all of his outstanding debts, which was not financially sustainable for her. She wanted to sell Paul's house, but was unable to do so without a death certificate. It was not until December of 2006, nearly 8 years after they originally went missing, when Paul and Sarah were legally declared dead. After obtaining Paul's death certificate, Sharon finally sold his house, but the money she earned from the sale, as well as proceeds from a $100,000 life insurance policy that Paul had taken out on Sarah, wound up going to Paul Roger. At one point, during a trip to Idaho, Teresa had a paternity test taken for Paul Roger and mailed the lab results to the Skiba family. The documentation showed that Paul was the child's father, but given their past history with Teresa, the Skiba family was not entirely trustful of the results. Sharon eventually moved back to Minnesota, but on December 27, 2013, she succumbed to cancer at the age of 74. Paul's father, CJ, would also pass away in December of 2020 at the age of 88. In February of 2019, Denver's Channel 9 News ran a 20th anniversary segment about the case, which revealed that during the past 5 years, detectives from the Westminster PD had interviewed 2 additional witnesses and resubmitted DNA evidence for analysis, but they were still not yet at the point where they could solve the case and make an arrest. Sarah's mother, Michelle Russell, was interviewed for the segment and stated, quote, "There are too many people who are remaining silent about this for too long, the murder of a 9-year-old girl. 20 years is an insane amount of time to not know what happened to your child. Please be a decent human being and come forward with your information, anonymously if you have to. End the silence and bring Sarah home." End quote. Unfortunately, no one has ever been charged for their role in the 3 victims' disappearances, so Paul Skiba, Sarah Skiba, and Lorenzo Shiver all continue to remain missing persons. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. While I've always had a particular interest in cases in which multiple people disappear at the same time, but this one is particularly unusual, as it involved a father, a daughter, and an employee who just happened to work for the father, all going missing simultaneously. In some cases like this, there can be ambiguity about whether one of the missing individuals was actually a victim, or if they may have killed the other victims themselves before they disappeared voluntarily. Since 24 years have passed, and no evidence has ever surfaced to suggest that Paul Skiba, Sarah Skiba, or Lorenzo Shiver are still alive, that scenario doesn't seem likely here, but I still see it brought up in online discussions about this case. What's particularly disturbing is that there's ample evidence to indicate that Sarah was murdered, and even if she was not the intended target, the responsible party didn't seem to have any qualms about killing a 9-year-old child. I'll state right up front that the original police investigation in this case is one of the worst I've ever seen, and I've covered a lot of bad ones on this podcast. When you consider that it involved a missing child who was likely a victim of foul play, the sheer ineptitude and indifference on display here was all the more disgraceful. At the outset, the disappearances wound up being reported to no less than 3 different law enforcement agencies: the Westminster Police Department, the Thornton Police Department, and the Granby County Sheriff's Office, and they all initially seemed to believe that the whole thing was a parental abduction, and that Paul had elected to run away with Sarah because he was unhappy over his custody agreement with his ex-wife. I mean, if the only missing victims were Paul and Sarah, then I suppose this theory wouldn't be all that unreasonable, but how could this account for Lorenzo Shiver's disappearance? Why would a loving father with 2 children of his own just decide to abandon them and throw everything away to go on the run with his boss? This theory could have been easily discounted if the Westminster PD had bothered to go to Tough Movers and perform a proper search of the parking lot, but this did not take place for days. Jerry Bybee's account of the officer, who somehow neglected to notice traces of blood on the moving truck and a scalp on the windshield, is truly mind-blowing. And even when the Westminster PD found bullet holes on the side of another moving truck, they still refused to believe that a crime had been committed and felt, well, maybe someone fired at the truck on a previous occasion. If this case had been treated as a homicide from the very start and a proper forensic analysis was performed of the trucks and the parking lot, this case may have been solved relatively quickly. Even if by chance the responsible parties left their DNA behind, the investigation was botched so badly that I wouldn't hold my breath that the evidence was properly preserved. However, in spite of these issues, law enforcement did ultimately reach a conclusion that I agree with. Paul was always the intended target of the crime, and Sarah and Lorenzo wound up being killed because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I suppose now would be a good time to address the theory that Lorenzo was not actually a victim and may have been personally involved in what happened to Paul and Sarah. Now, law enforcement has never given off any indication that they believe Lorenzo had a hand in the crime, but I still see this theory being pushed forward by amateur sleuths and online discussions about this case. I think this is based largely on the fact that while there was DNA, blood, and other physical evidence at the scene which matched Paul and Sarah, none of it matched Lorenzo. Of course, I seriously doubt that Lorenzo would have committed these two murders alone and then just decided to go on the run and stay off the radar for 24 years. Remember, Lorenzo's car was found in a parking lot several blocks away from Tough Movers. Why would he abandon it at that particular location, and what else would he use as transportation to get away? I suppose an alternate theory is that Lorenzo could have been involved in this crime with other individuals, but after Paul and Sarah were murdered, the others decided to double-cross Lorenzo by killing him and disposing of his body as well. After all, Lorenzo had been living with Bobby Joe Donovan at that time, and her family is suspected of being complicit in this crime. But nothing I've ever heard about Lorenzo's character would suggest that he was capable of something like this, as by all accounts, he was a very nice guy and devoted father, and it's hard to imagine someone with two children of their own being that willing to participate in the murder of a 9-year-old girl. Lorenzo's wife Misha found the rumors and allegations about his involvement to be so hurtful that she actually took the step of writing to the local media in order to remind everyone that Lorenzo was a human being and deserved to be treated as such. Dealing with the grief of having a loved one go missing is bad enough, but it must have been extra difficult for Lorenzo's family to hear accusations that he was a murderer. Personally, I think one of the reasons that Lorenzo's blood and DNA was not found at Tough Movers is because he may not have actually been killed there. If Paul and Sarah were shot in the parking lot, then the perpetrator or perpetrators may have forced Lorenzo to help them move the bodies into the truck at gunpoint. After they left the scene, Lorenzo was subsequently killed at another location, and all the bodies were disposed of together. Whatever happened, I definitely believe that Lorenzo was an innocent victim and had no complicity in this crime. Now, let's look at the timeline of how events played out on the day these three victims went missing. We do know that Paul, Sarah, and Lorenzo traveled to numerous locations to complete some moving jobs on February the 7th, and the last time they were confirmed to be alive is when Sarah made a phone call at 6:22 p.m. Details about this phone call are vague, but since this was 1999, I'm not entirely sure if a 9-year-old girl would have her own cell phone, so it's possible this call was made from a phone at Tough Movers, which is how the authorities were able to confirm that the victims were there at that time. I've seen one source state that the call was made to a 12-year-old relative of Teresa Donovan's, though it's never been publicly confirmed who this person actually was. But it seems likely that Paul, Sarah, and Lorenzo were ambushed at Tough Movers sometime after the call, as witnesses have confirmed that they saw the moving truck leaving the parking lot sometime between 7 and 8 p.m. It was apparently returned there at around midnight, meaning that the responsible parties were probably using that 4 to 5 hour window to dispose of the victims' bodies. Since bullet holes were found on the side of another moving truck, and motor oil was poured on the ground to cover up a pool of blood, the evidence suggests that at the very least, Paul was shot to death in the parking lot. As far as I know, no witnesses reported hearing gunshots that night, though someone did report hearing the sound of a woman's scream. I find it interesting that all the sources I've seen specifically use the word woman rather than girl. This would seem to rule out the possibility that Sarah was the source of the scream, meaning that a woman may have been present when the murders took place. I think that one of the most important details of this case is that Paul had not originally been planning to work that day. He ordinarily did not like to go out on moving jobs when Sarah was visiting, but he had agreed to take Jerry Bybee's shift since Jerry needed the day off to prepare for his grandfather's memorial. Investigators have repeatedly stated that they believe Paul was the intended target, and there's no indication that anyone had a motive to kill Jerry and wound up killing the others because they mistakenly assumed Jerry would be at Tough Movers. So you have to ask, how many people knew Paul would be there that evening? What's extra tragic about this whole situation is that if Sharon had not been away in Minnesota, Paul likely would have just left Sarah at home and had his mother watch over her. So it's horrible luck that Sarah may have been collateral damage and a premeditated murder plot for her father. Whoever was responsible for this crime, it seems very likely that there had to be multiple people involved, if not with the murder itself, but with the cover-up and disposal of evidence. Loading three bodies into a moving truck and disposing of them so thoroughly that they haven't been found in over two decades would be a pretty difficult task for just one person, particularly when you consider that the truck's large extension ramp was missing and may have been used to weigh down the victims in a body of water. It definitely seems like multiple people had to be involved with moving Paul and Lorenzo's cars, since they were both abandoned at separate apartment complexes. Lorenzo's vehicle was in a parking lot located several blocks away, so theoretically, the person who left it there could have made it back to Tough Movers on foot. However, Paul's car was abandoned several miles away in Denver. There was also traces of mud on the exterior of the vehicle, even though Paul was known for keeping it very clean. Hypothetically, if one person used the moving truck to transport the victim's bodies, an accomplice could have followed them in Paul's car, and if they went into a remote area, that could explain where the mud came from. Perhaps after they dumped their bodies, the driver of Paul's car abandoned it in Denver on their way back and hitched a ride with the driver of the truck when they returned to Tough Movers. But it also sounds like the truck was big enough to fit an entire vehicle in the back, so perhaps that's how they transported Paul's car. As far as anyone can tell, no significant connections have been found between the two apartment complexes and the victims, so it's possible they were just chosen at random. The purpose of moving the cars may have been to throw off the investigation, because if they weren't found parked at Tough Movers, then perhaps the authorities would be inclined to believe that the victims took off on their own. And, well, if that was their strategy, it actually worked. Another bizarre detail of this crime is that the perpetrators went to the trouble of putting a new lock on the gate to the Tough Movers parking lot. And once again, this strategy seemed to work out better than they could have imagined, since it was days before the police even bothered to enter the lot. So who could have had a motive to commit a crime like this? Well, there's one obvious answer to that question, but before I start discussing it, I want to explore other potential scenarios. One theory is that the murders may have been drug-related, because Paul was supposedly involved in drug dealing and would let pushers park their vehicles in his lot. Of course, this theory was pushed forward by Teresa Donovan, and I would ordinarily take it with a huge grain of salt, but surprisingly, the former lead detective, Pat Long, actually told Lorenzo Shiver's family that he believed this was what happened. So if law enforcement was willing to entertain this drug theory, could that mean they have additional information to suggest it might be true? Well, we do know that Paul had a few prior scrapes with the law in the past, some of which involved drugs, and he did apparently smoke marijuana recreationally. But Paul's family insisted that he never would have done anything illegal while Sarah was around, as due to his custody agreement, I'm sure he would have wanted to paint himself as the most responsible father possible. If Paul was allowing drug dealers to use his parking lot, then you think he would have done everything to keep Sarah away from that place. The fact that he took her along with him on multiple moving jobs which lasted the entire day suggests that he did not believe there was any danger for himself or his daughter. Another individual who was pushed forward as a potential suspect was Paul's cousin, Herbert Michael Himes. Herbert had been Paul's original partner when he started Tough Movers, but sometime during the late 1980s, Herbert was arrested for aggravated robbery and received a 6-year prison sentence. After he was released, Herbert went back to work at Tough Movers, but the story goes that Paul caught him stealing money from the business and cut Herbert out. In February of 2008, reporter Jessica Centers published an extensive article about this story for the Denver-based publication Westword, titled A Cold Case Frozen in Time. When Herbert was asked to provide comment for the article, his response was, quote, "I quit the business because I was making more money in the stock market. I don't know nothing about this case. Kiss my ass. End quote. So it's unclear to me if Paul and Herbert had a major falling out, but if they did, I can see why Herbert would seem like a promising suspect, especially when you consider that he was a convicted criminal who had already served time in prison. But unfortunately, other than the brief reference to him in the aforementioned Westward article, there's really not all that much information out there about Herbert. We don't know if he was in the Denver area on the night the disappearances took place, or if he had an alibi, and even if he still had a grudge against Paul, would it have been strong enough to drive him to murder a 9-year-old girl? And once again, the biggest theory with any theories involving Herbert or drug dealers is that Paul was not originally scheduled to work on February the 7th, so could any of these people have known he would show up to Tough Movers at that particular time on a Sunday night? Sure, they could have been following Paul around and had no qualms about murdering his daughter, but wouldn't it still be easier to kill Paul at a time when he didn't have an adult male like Lorenzo with him? Why put yourself into a situation where you'll be required to get rid of 3 bodies rather than 1? No, I get the impression that this crime was committed by someone who had intimate knowledge of Paul's routine, as well as a motive to want him gone. So this finally leads us to Teresa Donovan, and I can definitely understand why she has garnered more suspicion than anyone else. While she agreed to do interviews in the years following the disappearances and use them as an outlet to push forward the theory that the trio were murdered by drug dealers, she eventually decided to shy away from the spotlight and has not talked about the case publicly in quite some time. I find it unusual that she flat out admitted that she failed a polygraph, and while I obviously don't put much stock into the results, this detail has never been publicly confirmed by law enforcement, and it's very rare that you'll find potential suspects take the initiative to acknowledge something like that on their own accord. But Teresa has insisted that she did tell the police the identities of the individuals responsible for this crime, but they wouldn't listen to her. Law enforcement has never named Teresa or anyone else from her family as a suspect or person of interest, so if they have their own feelings about who was responsible for the crime, they've kept them to themselves. But let's look at the timeline of events. According to Sharon, Paul called her on Friday to inform her that she was planning to kick Teresa out of their house on Sunday night, so it seems like one hell of a coincidence that he would happen to go missing before this took place. It sounds like Paul had reached the end of his rope with Teresa, but had still been keeping her around for the sake of her son, Paul Roger, even though Paul wasn't 100% certain he was the boy's father. However, if Paul had been able to prove his paternity while he was still alive, he likely would have sought full custody of the child, and given Teresa's alleged shortcomings as a mother, there's a good chance that the court would have ruled in Paul's favor. When you consider these circumstances, Teresa definitely had motive for wanting Paul gone. Jerry Bybee claimed that Teresa once told him she had gone to Tough Movers on the night the 3 victims went missing, but she asked Jerry not to inform the police. If true, then that's a major red flag, and while I'm wondering why Teresa would even admit to something like this, perhaps she was paranoid some eyewitnesses may have seen her at Tough Movers that night and needed to come up with a story to account for it. Like I mentioned earlier, a witness reported hearing a woman scream near Tough Movers that night, so could it have been Teresa? But even if Teresa committed these murders, she was on disability at the time due to issues with arthritis, so it seems unlikely that she would have been capable of covering up the crime and disposing of the bodies all by herself. So if she needed assistance, who would be a better person to turn to than a family member? Of course, there's also the fact that Teresa's sister, Bobby Joe, just happened to be living with Lorenzo at the time he went missing. There haven't been many details shared about the nature of Bobby Joe and Lorenzo's relationship, but since it has been reported that Lorenzo and his wife Misha have been talking about a possible reconciliation, I'm guessing that his relationship with Bobby Joe may not have had much of a long-term future. When Lorenzo went missing, Bobby Joe made that cryptic remark about how she knew he wasn't coming back, and it does not sound like she participated in the search effort for him. And Bobby Joe also took the step of boxing up all the belongings for Lorenzo's son Josh and essentially kicking him out of her house, which is a pretty cold thing to do to a teenage boy whose father has gone missing. Her actions seem all the more bizarre When you consider that the authorities were still treating Paul and Sarah's disappearances as a parental abduction at the time, and were adamant that no crime had been committed, so how could Bobby Joe be so certain that Lorenzo was never coming back? So we have a pair of sisters whose spouses vanished at the exact same time, and they both seemed rather nonchalant about the situation. I'm not saying that Bobby Joe was directly involved in these disappearances, but if one or more of her siblings were responsible, she likely knew what happened and kept her mouth shut. Of course, suspicion about Teresa and Bobby Joe only increases when you look at the actions of their brother, Tom Donovan, who is currently serving a 28-year prison sentence for attempting to murder their mother. Even if you discount that, Tom displayed a lot of unstable behavior following the disappearances, such as phoning up Sharon and informing her that Paul and Sarah had been shot in the head and the same thing was going to happen to her. Months earlier, Paul had also fired Tom from Tough Movers, and if you look at the timeline, it appears that Lorenzo was hired to replace him. So it sounds like Tom may have had a personal grudge against both men and a motive to harm them, in addition to Paul having relationship issues with his sister. For all we know, Teresa could have enlisted Tom to assist her with the situation, but she did not anticipate that he would go so far as to murder three people. In fact, if Teresa was present in the Tough Movers parking lot that night and was the source of the scream that the witness heard, perhaps she was left genuinely shocked by her brother's outburst of violence. Yes, there is no direct evidence linking Tom to this crime, but anyone unstable enough to stab his own mother five times would have been capable of shooting a 9-year-old girl. The crime is a bit of a weird contradiction because it simultaneously comes off as professional and sloppy. On one hand, the responsible parties did a very thorough job of disposing of the victims' bodies and cleaning the interior of the moving truck, as well as moving Paul and Lorenzo's vehicles and wiping them both clean of fingerprints. But on the other hand, they did a pretty half-assed job cleaning the exterior of the truck and left behind blood evidence and a scalp fragment. It makes the whole situation with the police investigation all the more frustrating because if they had not done such a half-assed job following through on this and actually collected evidence immediately, then they may have been able to build a case against someone. At the very least, I get the impression that detectives who have worked on this case in recent years have done a much more professional job and likely have their own ideas about what happened, but just lack the evidence to make an arrest. If Tom Donovan was the individual who committed these murders, then at the very least, he is going to be locked up for the next 2 decades and won't harm anyone else, but that doesn't offer much comfort for the victims' families when their bodies have yet to be found and no one has been formally charged with this crime. And even if Tom is guilty, I'm sure he didn't act alone, and there may be others out there, such as his siblings, who know exactly what happened and are keeping their mouths shut. Since there are 3 victims in this story, that means there are a ton of people who have suffered these past 24 years. Paul Skiba's parents have both passed away, but he still has a surviving brother and a number of friends, such as Jerry Bybee, who are still searching for answers. Lorenzo Shiver's 2 children have had to grow up without their father, and most heartbreakingly, Michelle Russell lost her own daughter and has had to live with the knowledge that Sarah was likely murdered over something she had nothing to do with. And another victim in this story is Paul Roger, who was still a baby when all this went down. But regardless of whether or not Paul Skiba was actually his biological father, it seems clear that Paul was going to do everything he could to help him. Paul Roger would now be 24 years old, and even though he has been raised by someone who is suspected of being involved in this crime, I hope he has still managed to have a decent life. I definitely believe there are people out there who know exactly what happened to these 3 missing victims, and all it would take to break this case wide open is for the right person to come forward. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearances of Paul Skiba, Sarah Skiba, and Lorenzo Shiver, please contact the Westminster Police Department at 303-658-6430. That's 303-658-6430. If you wish to remain anonymous, you can also call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. That's 720-913-7867. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released an episode about the unsolved 2012 kidnapping of Violet Ripken, the mother of famous Baltimore Orioles baseball player Cal Ripken Jr., who was abducted from her home by an unidentified man who inexplicably held her in captivity for 23 hours before returning her unharmed. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the unexplained 1984 death of Kurt McFall. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon these past few weeks, and they are Alexis C., Jason M., Louise T.L., and Meow Meow Metalhead. Thank you all so much for your support. Another reminder that later this year, The Trail Went Cold will be in attendance at two separate CrimeCon events. The first one is CrimeCon UK, which is returning to London and will be held at the Tower Bridge Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa on June the 10th and 11th. And 2 months after that, I'll be attending the regular CrimeCon event, which will be held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, and this time around, the same code is valid for both events. So in order to purchase tickets and get a 10% discount, you can either visit crimecon.co.uk or crimecon.com and use the special promo code COLE23. That's COLE23. In addition, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th until the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. We've got a specialized promo code which you can use in order to get a 15% discount on tickets to the event, so if you would like to purchase tickets, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use our promo code TRAIL. Once again, in order to get a 15% discount, visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com and the promo code is TRAIL. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.